My father was a coal miner most of his life, and then worked another 20 years for British Leyland when they had a plant in the area where we lived. We had a piano in the house, and he would play a piano most nights. He wasn't particularly gifted, but he always stuck with it, and he encouraged me to play an instrument. And like most rebellious sons, I said, "Well, I'm not playing the one you play, so I'm going to pick up guitar."
Everyone has ambitions. To start their own business, to lose weight, to launch a podcast. But for most of us, those ambitions are still on the to-do list. We'll get round to them one day. But some people overcome procrastination. That thing you'd love to do, they knew the risks, but said screw it and just did it anyway. On the Screw It, Just Do It podcast, I'm on a mission to answer one simple question. How do you get to where you want to be? Joining me are inspirational entrepreneurs, sports stars, entertainers, and authors who took the leap. They became the people they wanted to be. They did what they always wanted to do. In this series of revealing, challenging, and often surprising conversations, they might just help you discover how to do it too. So you like listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought of hosting your own? Whilst I started out in the audio space with BBC Radio, I now not only host this podcast, but I also run a podcast agency called Podpreneur, where we produce podcasts with purpose. We've launched hundreds of podcasts that are listened to in over 180 countries, where 9 out of 10 podcasts we launch hit the top end of the charts globally. We help CEOs, business leaders, experts, and brands become the authoritative voice of their industry through developing a strong brand message, constantly and consistently delivered by a well-executed content strategy. If you'd like to book a free strategy call to chat about your podcast idea, just go to podpreneur.co.uk. You can also grab a free copy of my perfect podcast launch plan. Welcome to another episode of Screw It, Just Do It with me, Alex, and my guest today, Andy Mooney. Andy is a renowned business leader with over 35 years of experience leading global brands to success. Who was a child, wanted to be a rock star. Well, now he's the CEO of Fender Musical Instruments, the world's leading guitar and musical instrument manufacturer, who includes some of the world's leading guitarists playing their instruments. Prior to joining Fender, Andy worked with some of the world's most iconic brands, including Nike, Disney, and Quicksilver. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you.
So look, most guests on the show have had a screw it, just do it moment or moments where they took a big risk and it paid off. It took them from where they were to where they are now. Can you share a screw it, just do it moment with us, Andy?
Yeah, I never went to college and felt that when I was living in the UK at the time that most business leaders had a finance background. So I literally got my finance qualifications by correspondence course. And when I was qualified at the ripe old age of 25 and arrogant enough to feel I warranted a CEO title, a CFO title rather. The only company that was kind of crazy enough to give me that title was a small company called Nike for their UK operation that time was based in Halifax in Yorkshire. So I joined them in 80 and spent 2 years doing finance, but quickly learned that doing the books was not really the most important aspect of my job. My most important aspect was buying shoes from the parent company 6 months in advance. So I was a bit like a department store buyer. If you got it right, you were good. If you got it wrong, you were out the door. And I knew nothing about buying shoes. So I spent time gaining intel. I went out on the road with the reps to talk to dealers. I went to road race events to talk to runners. And then I always did something a little off the beaten track. So I hung out in Brixton with Jamaican kids because they were setting the trends. And I'd go back to my CEO and say, we need to spend more money on high-cut leather basketball boots because that's what the Jamaican kids are wearing. Or we need to spend more money on these expensive running shoes because runners will pay for them. And he would, every month he'd say, calm down, all of this is too risky. And I said, hey, I understand. Well, let me push the boat out a little, cut me some slack. I've done my homework. And by the way, I'll give you a side bet of my money, $100 a month, that I'm more right than you are. So after 6 months of collecting the money, Friday afternoon, he called me into the office and said, okay, we're not going to fight anymore about what you're going to buy. He said, I appreciate that you've done your work. We're going to fight about how much you want to spend, because you're always coming in here asking for more and more money, because Nike was growing like a weed. And I go, okay, that's great. And he goes, by the way, what newspapers do you take over the weekend? And I say, well, the Financial Times and the Observer, I think, back then. And he said, oh, I'm so glad I asked, because we're advertising your position as CFO this weekend. And I go, wow, Friday afternoon, that's usually when you get your pink slip. And he said, no, don't worry. He goes, we can get another CFO. We can't get another one of you to do what you're doing.
That's brilliant.
They said, we want you to kind of move in and lead marketing. And I was 27. So I said, okay, how long do I have to think about this? And he said, what don't you quite understand about us advertising your position in the newspaper? So I moved into marketing and out of finance at 27, never moved back.
Wow.
And it was really the door opening in marketing that opened the next big door, which was moving to the States 2 years later.
And if you've seen the Air Jordan movie that's just come out a couple of months back?
No, I haven't yet. I'll probably get round to it. But from what I've learned, as you might expect, the story is totally inaccurate.
Right. I only saw it last week with a guy, so I thought I'd ask you. Yeah.
Well, the two, you have to separate who signed Michael from who built the Jordan brand. And, you know, Phil Knight, the founder, and Howard Slusher were always instrumental in signing the big deals. They just literally bypassed. I mean, Phil walked into my office one morning when I was chief marketing officer and said, I just signed Brazil, the soccer team. And I go, okay, great. And I said, how much for? He goes, 100 million.
Whoa.
And he goes, no, but it's over 10 years, so it's only 10 million a year. I go, Phil, I don't have 10 million left in my budget to spend. He goes, it's not your budget. it's my budget. He had 70% of the voting stock, still does. And, you know, he made decisions that he believed were in the long-term best interest of the brand. So he was involved in the Tiger deal, Agassi deal, Bo Jackson, and definitely Michael. But the two guys who built the brand, Peter Moore, who is apparently featured in the movie, and Rob Strasser, who was the chief marketing officer at the time.
Interesting. And did you, like, one of my favorite books, and again, I don't know, you know, how much stock you put to it, but is the Shoe Dog book.
Yeah, it's funny. I unfortunately, I went up, my last visit to Portland was about 3 months ago for the remembrance for Dan Wyden from Wyden and Kennedy fame. And Portland still has, I believe, the largest kind of analog bookstore in the world on Burnside Avenue called Powell's Books. So I had an hour to kill before the event, walked in there, and front and center was Phil's book, and I hadn't got around to reading it. And, you know, I read it cover to cover over the next 2 or 3 days, and then wrote him a very heartfelt note, because I thought it was extremely well written, completely accurate, completely self-effacing, which is what Phil always was. And I got a nice note back from him kind of thanking me. So
I love that book. I thought it's fantastic. So if it's, you know, accurate, then that's awesome to hear. And look, yourself, I've read about how your family couldn't afford to buy a Fender guitar when you were growing up, and now I read you've got a collection of more than 50 guitars yourself. You've probably updated that, but what was your experience growing up shaping your relationship with music, and how does it feel to now be CEO of a company that makes those guitars?
It's pretty remarkable. My father was a coal miner most of his life, and then, you know, worked another 20 years for British Leyland when they had a plant in the area where we lived. We had a piano in the house, and he would play a piano most nights. He wasn't particularly gifted, but he always stuck with it, and he encouraged me to play an instrument. And like most rebellious sons, I said, well, I'm not playing the one you play, so I'm going to pick up guitar. So I took classical guitar lessons on a cheap nylon strung Spanish acoustic. And then, as I say, when I got to high school and I started to get interested in girls, that's when I had to switch to electric and join the band.
Makes sense.
And I played all sorts of kind of variations of guitar, and eventually did manage to get a Fender Music Master, which was the absolute entry level, you know, Fender you could get at the time. And I stuck with it for years until really at the point when I moved to the States and kind of gave up on the idea that my career was going to be connected to music. But a few years after I joined Nike, I'd given up all. I literally had no guitars in the house, nothing. One of my very good friends, a guy called Alan Rogan, who was the guitar tech for Pete Townshend most of his life, but also Angus Young and some of the great guitarists of the world. He was in town with AC/DC, stopped by the house and dropped me off a book, basically it's by Bacon and Dace, The History of Fender. So on a whim, I decided to collect every guitar that was pictured in that book.
No way.
And that was, you know, a 30-year labor of love. But there were still gaps even by the time I joined Fender. But I'd already collected guitars and went back to 52 and 55, very origins of the company. Since then, of course, it's gotten crazy. So 50's become 100.
Has it? Wow. Yeah. Wow. And who, interested to know, Andy, who that we would know, say, from plays Fender instrument, they don't even have to play Fender instrument, what musicians would have seen your collection, like come up to your house and seen what you've got?
Well, one interesting event is, you know, we live in LA, so when my daughter, who's 16 now, went to grade school, you know, the school she's in has a lot of personalities. One of them, as I found out, Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine.
Wow, yeah.
And at one of the fundraising events, Tom had put one of his guitars up for auction, which I wasn't too interested in, but it came with an hour's lessons, personal lesson, the guitar from Tom. So I go, I'm winning this. So I outbid everybody to win it, and then, you know, went up to meet him at his home. You know, and Tom is kind of legendary for not endorsing anything. He literally, you know, puts tape over the brand of amp and speaker cabinet he uses. So I went up to him, and the guitar that I took up that day was actually a Chris Shiflett signature guitar, the guitarist from the Foo Fighters. So I go up there, I get my ears lesson, you know, I'm a huge Rage and Audioslave fan, and, you know, played a number of their songs, but there's always parts of the song that, you know, you're trying to pick up how it was done on YouTube or lessons or tabs. They never quite all seem to be right. So, you know, he gave me some really great insights. Not just on how to play the songs I love, but the whole process of writing music and his approach, which is really remarkable. And at the end of the session, he goes, "What guitar is that you're playing?" And I said, "You know, it's a Chris Shiflett signature." He goes, "Oh, do you do signature guitars?" I said, "Yeah, we do. Not that many, but we do." He goes, "Would you do mine?" And I go, "Yeah, but of course we would, but you don't do that type of thing." And he goes, "Well," he said, "I know I don't really," he goes, "but people are knocking off my guitars. They're very distinctive on the web.
Right.
And I'm getting nothing for it. So I would rather do it formally and then put the money to good use for his kind of foundation work that he does either with schools or with, you know, convicts who rehabilitate through the process of playing guitar." And we were like, "Okay, great." So now Soul Power, with the first of his guitars, is now one of those 100 in my collection.
Brilliant. I love that. And interested to know, Andy, what else were you passionate about growing up? Was it just the guitar? Was it other things?
Well, I mean, I would say I've always been fiercely competitive. And, you know, I think particularly during my Nike days, that served me really, really well. And I've always said that I felt that kind of fear was the primary limiting factor for most people kind of reaching their full potential. I came from nothing, so I wasn't scared about losing anything that I had gained. And I always was a fierce competitor and advocated for what I felt was the right thing to do for the company, even though sometimes it was either controversial or not politically in my own best interest. You know, it's a pretty high risk strategy. It served me well in the long run, but I think because of my financial training and my passion for music, I always describe myself as this unusual blend of right brain, left brain. But a lot of the best business ideas I've had have been very creative ideas, and every one of them has got me close to getting fired.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best example really was, you know, when I joined Disney, it was a turnaround. Disney Consumer Products was in severe decline. And I was really kind of struggling with the team there to kind of find something that could ignite the business. And I went on a kind of onboarding experience to Arizona, of all places, to see an ice show in the middle of the desert. It seemed a little bit of a kind of paradox to me. But I went to the ice show. And again, because by this time I was very high in the ranks at Disney, they wanted to, you know, have me go in the back door, VIP entrance, you know, you get to see. And I go, no, I don't want to do that. That's not what normal people do. I'm not going to see the experience through their eyes. So I waited in line outside the venue just like everybody else did. And I saw all of these mothers and daughters, you know, decked out in princess regalia, none of which we made. You know, I asked some of them, they must have thought it was strange at the time. I go, you know, where did you get this? And most of the mothers said, we literally sewed this up at home. And I said, well, if we made this available for you, would you buy it? And they said, yeah, we'd buy lots of it. So the next day I ran, you know, when it ran out of the office and said, we're going to do this Disney princess thing. And they said, yeah, we kind of thought about that idea a little, but Roy Disney hates that idea. And luckily, Michael Eisner and Bob Iger defended the idea and said, hey, give it a shot. And he said, nothing else is working right now, so this seems like a good idea. So we pushed ahead, and it was ended up being a very big idea.
Well, it's something you take for granted, isn't it? Like, I've got two teenage daughters, and I'm sure I've spent more than a few pounds looking at, like, them, and they're 16 and 14 now, but, you know, one of those closets, and you open it up, and it's literally just full of princess stuff.
Yeah, my daughter, Rose, wasn't born at the time, but I remember after we'd kind of figured out that there was something there, I said, if you open the door of a young girl's bedroom who's in that kind of demographic where they're going through fantasy role play and dress up, I go, what can we princessify? And the answer was every single thing in the room, right down to the paint on the wall, which we did.
Really? I didn't know.
Yeah. Literally every single thing in the room we princessified.
Wow. Wow, 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 wow. And look, interested to know as well, like, you know, going back to your background, what was it like growing up? Catholic father, I believe, Protestant mother. I believe they chose a part of town that was relatively neutral. But yeah, interested to know what was that like? And also on the back of that, how much did they influence who you are today, Andy, as well?
Well, I think they both, you know, my father has passed, my mother's still alive, but they both had, you know, strong values and very, very disciplined work ethic. But, you know, it's, my father was very crafty is the right word, but he was very skilled at pointing me in a direction without hitting me over the head. So, you know, for example, when I was getting to the point where, what am I going to do after I leave high school? He took me down the mine. And he didn't take me down the mine to kind of to convince me to either do it or not do it. He just let me see it. And that was enough reason for me to think, no, this is not what I want to do. But as we were literally, as we were coming back up out of the mine, he said to me, it would be good if you would be the first one in the family to actually work with your head and not your hand. And that left a lasting impression on me.
Yeah, I bet it did. And do you think that's where you got, you know, these qualities that you have to challenge, you know, other people's opinions and to try ideas out? I mean, I read that you're also a key mover in the introduction of, like, limited edition trainers as well.
Well, the kind of dual backstory behind that was one of the initiatives that I pushed for at Nike was, at the time, I think we were maybe a $3 or $4 billion company, but we had very bold ambitions. And I went to the local mall and realized that we had 16 open accounts and they were all selling the same product and starting to beat each other up on price. And I used to describe that as the post-World War II Coca-Cola model, which is sell them all the same bottle of Coke and just have them price promote against each other all day long. I said, we're never going to get to 10 billion with this strategy. I go, well, what we really need to do is to develop unique product lines for every one of those accounts. And when I went back in with that idea, it was, people looked at me like I had two heads. It's like, that's impossible. You'll never do that. Marketing didn't want to do it. Production didn't want to do it. But then something interesting happened, because we were pivoting at that time out of Korea and Taiwan as production sources, because those countries were trading up out of making shoes into making computer electronics. So all of a sudden, we had opened these massive factories in China and Thailand and Indonesia, and they only had the capability to make pretty simple footwear. And all of a sudden, you know, production was saying, we need volume to fill these factories. And I go, I can solve that problem for you. If I go to JCPenney's, for example, and we do a limited run for them that they can promote independently, I think I can get, for example, 300,000 pairs from them. And so I was fortunate that the strategy that I believed was fundamentally important came at a time where it was important to the company too. But, you know, by the time I left, that aspect of the business, which was all generally at the low end, was already about half of the total business.
Wow.
But I had developed a reputation of being a bottom feeder. You know, it's like, you know, all of this guy does is he kind of knocks off the shoes that we develop and he sells them at a lower price.
Yeah.
People forgot that these shoes were going direct from the factory to the dealer. And when you looked at the total profit chain, we were actually making more money on these than a kind of catalog product. But nonetheless, I thought, oh, well, now I've got an image problem. But I'd been successful enough. I bought my first semi-decent car. I bought a black Porsche 924 used car, which is not even a Porsche. It's a Volkswagen, to be true. I'm driving to the office in the first day, and some guy pulls up alongside me in a limited edition, Wolfsburg edition of my car. And I go, oh, wow. So I kind of researched that and figured it was just my car with different upholstery with the $5,000 higher upcharge. And then I go, well, I wonder if that would work for shoes. So I literally walked along the hallway to one of the designers I had a relationship with and said, hey, take the most expensive shoes that we make. Find the most exotic leathers you can find. I'll develop a limited edition hang tag and we'll push this board out and see what happens. And then, so we did push it out. We got 50 million in orders in the first at bat. So that was the genesis. Wow. For it. But again, it all came from just real life observation about a business model that was working in automotive, that maybe this is going to work in shoes, and it did.
And was that, Andy, like when we're talking like limited edition shoes then, is that like a limited edition for a specific athlete or specific just a type of shoe?
That was a collection of shoes that we called limited edition that was. And again, I kind of ran at crosshairs with a lot of my peers at the company at the time, because the company was all about function. And here I was making shoes with crocodile skin. And this was all about fashion, candidly.
Yeah, yeah.
And my viewpoint was, I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time. And again, if you look at the types of collaborations that Nike's doing now, but also how dominant they are in professional sports, I think both paths are actually good for the brand.
Yeah. And look, after Nike and Disney, Fender, so iconic brand in the music industry, I think something like 80 years now coming up to. What were your initial thoughts when you were contacted about the possibility of becoming the CEO of such an iconic brand? If you enjoy listening to podcasts and you feel inspired to start your own, you can get a copy of my free podcast launch checklist by going to podpreneur.co.uk/launch checklist. And if you'd like the hands-on help and support of myself and my team at my podcast agency, Podpreneur, we've been producing podcasts with purpose internationally since 2019. Just drop me a line about your podcast idea to alex@podpreneur.co.uk. But if you prefer to do it all yourself, but with my guidance, you can join the waitlist for my upcoming podcast academy by going to podpreneur.co.uk/academy.
Well, I was first approached to be CEO directly after I left Nike, and the company was headquartered in Scottsdale, Arizona. And my daughter was 5 at the time, and my wife and I were, well, you know, this could work. But literally on the eve of that happening, my daughter was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And my wife and I decided to kind of hunker down, keep her in the school that she was in. you know, adjust to kind of administering to her, particularly at that young age. And that was really the reason I ended up taking the Quicksilver situation as opposed to some other CEO role, because they were within driving distance of my home.
Right.
And it seemed like a good opportunity at the time. But, you know, when Quicksilver and I parted ways, within 24 hours of the announcement coming out, I get a call from Mark Fukunaga, the chairman of Fender, and he goes, "Would you reconsider becoming CEO?" And I go, "Mark, I go, this is absolutely my dream job, but you're still in Scottsdale and my daughter still has type 1 diabetes." And he goes, "Well, we've actually opened a lease on Sunset and Gower in New York and Googled your home address, and it's a 15-minute drive." I go, Mark, you had me at Sunset and Gower.
Yeah. That's brilliant.
So, you know, the plan is aligned, and it's worked remarkably well, I think, from the time I joined.
That's great to hear. They've clearly done their research and wanted their man and got him. And for you, when you thought of Fender, the brand, at that time, you obviously knew the history of the company, being collecting guitars, but what came to mind for yourself? What kind of images, what kind of word come up in your mind?
Well, I mean, I literally describe myself as a guitar geek with big company experience. So, you know, even in my opening town hall address to the folks in Scottsdale, and I started to describe how, when I eventually had enough money to buy a Stratocaster, how I set it up exactly like Richie Blackmore set it up. Really just to illustrate the point that I kind of was a passionate and deep advocate of the brand. I remember one of the long-serving employees at the end of the presentation came up to me at the end and he goes, "I said, I thought I was going to hate you, but you actually might get it." But the company at that time was jointly owned by two private equity companies, Servco, which is the majority owner now out of Hawaii, and TPG. And they couldn't be more different. I mean, Servco has been an investor in Fender for 30 years, which is highly unusual for a private equity company. And TPG was, you know, much more traditional, 5 years, 7 years in and out. TPG was very interested in exploring the potential of the brand in the digital space, but they didn't know what that meant, and neither did I. Servco was very interested in getting a steward for the existing business that on which all of the legacy had been built. So I kind of checked the Servco box and semi-checked the digital box. But when I joined, what we first did, as I always do, is gather some data. You know, who's actually buying our guitars and why? And we conducted probably what was the most comprehensive piece of research done in the industry. And five insights came out of that shaped everything that we did, including a move into digital. You know, one was that 45% of the guitars that we sell every year goes to a first-time player, way higher than anybody would have speculated.
Yeah.
And as you alluded to, 90% of them abandon the guitar in the first 90 in the first year, if not the first 90 days. But the 10% who don't tend to commit to the instrument for life. The salmon that make it through the dam, as it were, have a lifetime value of $10,000. They're very high-value customers. And the trend in learning was towards digital learning online as opposed to in person. So that kind of pointed us in the direction of what to do in digital. And we created Fender Play as a result of that, primarily to just, you know, create a tool that would encourage people to commit to the instrument for longer life. The other big aha was that 50% of the new players coming in were women. That was a complete shocker.
Really?
Yeah, complete shocker. And the reason we were blindsided on that a little was, one, they were predominantly coming in through the acoustic segment.
Yeah.
And we were much stronger in the electric segment than the acoustic segment. And they were not buying in traditional music stores, which is a very intimidating environment for any new player. And even more so, I think, for women, because there's nobody in the store to relate to. So that shaped our marketing, shaped all of our communication. And, you know, those insights, as I say, have really kind of shaped a lot of what we've done over the last, you know, seven going on 8 years now.
And during lockdown, Andy, interested to know, like, the different dynamic. You've got venues shutting down, musicians cancelling tours, but then you've got a lot of people at home who are looking for things to do. Like my industry, podcast just exploded. how did things look from your point of view? Did you grow? Did you do the complete opposite? Or did it stay the same? How did sales go?
Well, I'll give you two separate answers for that. You know, the first month of COVID, I think it was for most people, was absolutely terrifying. I mean, 90% of our dealers were closed worldwide. Both our factories were closed. Most of our overseas suppliers were closed. So we went into our own lockdown mode. You know, we took massive salary cuts, tried to preserve cash, and kind of hunkered down for what we thought was going to be a nightmare. And then a month later, the orders just flowed in like I've never seen before. And almost simultaneously, one of the things that we did, not really as a business initiative, but because all of us, the management team, we all had kids at home, and we had Fender Play, which at that time had about 125,000, 150,000 paying subscribers, which was, we were perfectly happy with the progress, but we offered Fender Play for free for 90 days, purely as a gesture of goodwill to give parents stuck at home something that they could do, you know, with their kids.
Yeah.
And we thought, oh, well, maybe we'll get another 50,000, and maybe even get another 100,000, we'll sign up. We got 100,000 signed up in the first week.
No way.
And we tapped out at nearly 1 million people signing up for the free version of Fender Play.
Unbelievable.
And I think that was another kind of accelerant for the growth. So to answer your business question, you know, at 2015, when I joined the company, we were roughly a $400 million company, and, you know, growing nicely in the kind of high single digit realm. We're now just shy of a billion.
Wow.
So we exploded through COVID, and fortunately, the business has normalized, but it's normalized at a much higher plateau. So if you'd have drawn our business plan pre-COVID, basically our business plan was to kind of consistently grow something like 10% a year. What happened is we shot up 30, 40% a year for the years of COVID, and now we've kind of plateaued at this new level. So we're essentially 2 or 3 years ahead of our original business plan.
Wow. And was that obviously fantastic for the bottom line, et cetera, but was that a challenge in other manners, that, and again, staff, recruitment, retention, all those kinds of things?
Yeah. I mean, you know, given my age, I was pretty old school, thinking that, oh, this working from home, this is never going to work. But the first thing we had to do is, even with the executive team, you know, is to adjust the working from home. And in the early days, when we were in crisis mode, it was literally we were getting up every morning and beginning the day and figuring out what horror story we had to deal with. And pretty soon I realized that we were actually more connected as a team remotely than we were in person. You know, and even today, my head of HR lives in Idaho. My CFO is in San Francisco. My head of sales is in Sedona. And, you know, I'm probably in the office maybe 5 days out of the month, even though it's in my hometown.
Wow, interesting.
And we never missed a beat. And in fact, I think in some ways we're more productive than using the old model.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And as CEO, how do you ensure, when you've got, you know, a brand with such a rich history, how do you stay relevant? How do you continue to innovate, especially off the results that you saw with lockdown and Fender Play, etc.?
Well, the I always, from a business perspective, I always say I like to swim with the tide, not against it. So I was fortunate at Nike and at Disney and now at Fender in working in categories that have organic growth. You know, you've seen explosive growth in sports, entertainment, and in music. So on the external influences on the business, we are enjoying the unbelievable demand for live music, especially now post-COVID, but also the unbelievable demand for recorded music through people streaming. And most of the people who are coming into streaming now are actually listening to back catalog music, which is predominantly guitar-based music. And I drive my daughter to school every day, and she's just discovered the Beatles. I think that's normal. I mean, kids these days, there's no such thing as a genre. They just My daughter said something actually pretty fascinating to me about a week ago. She said, you know, if the Beatles kind of were given birth today, they wouldn't fit into one of Apple's genres. She goes, where would you put Maxwell's Silver Hammer? which particular genre would that fit into? Or, you know, back in the USSR, they were creative on so many multiple fronts. So I think the companies had a rich history in product innovation. But I think the thing that the current team has brought to the table is when we were a $400 million company, we were spending 4% on 4% of revenues on marketing. So $16 million, all of it was spent in trade. So I used to describe new product offerings as trees falling in the forest because nobody knew about them. Today, at a $1 billion company, we're spending 10% on marketing. So we're spending $100 million. And it's predominantly being spent in social media. So we're adding to the organic growth by the money that we're spending and the way that we're spending it. But we're also now, I mean, I was very fortunate about 2 or 3 years into the role to meet Phyllis Fender, Leo's widow. And she reminded me of something that Leo had said, that he believed that artists were angels and God had put him on earth to give them wings to fly. Well, I think that's the best job description you've ever imagined in your life. So we were always focused on professional musicians, but and still are. But now we're just as focused on bringing new people to guitar, whether it's through Fender Play or through our marketing efforts, and bringing the increasingly diverse universe of players to guitar, whether it's by gender, by geography, or genre. I think the guitar business has never been in better shape because of the breadth of music that people want to play out there these days.
It's interesting what you said about your daughter, because my wife and I heard music coming from our eldest daughter, who's 16 as well, and it's literally all 90s music. But they probably don't think of it as 90s music. Like we think, you know, there's a, you know, Heart 90s radio station or Kiss 90s, whatever, you know, they're putting it in that box. But for them, it's just music. They've just heard it on maybe a movie soundtrack or something like that, and they've dived in and found out more about that type of music, which I think is just brilliant.
Yeah, I'm going with my daughter to a festival, Bottle Rocket, here up in Napa in a couple of weeks. And one of the bands she's most excited about seeing is Duran Duran.
Yeah. Brilliant. I was going to say to you, what was the last live music you saw? What was the last live music gig you saw? And what's the next one? The next one's Duran Duran. And what's the past one?
Well, the last concert I saw, and I'm actually going to go see them again in the same site where Coachella is. It was one of my favorite bands is Tool.
Yeah,
I am a heavy metal devotee all the way back to my father bought me this scratchy old record player, and he gave me enough money to buy two singles. And the two singles I bought, and it's remarkable to think of, both of them were in the top 10, and one of them appeared on Top of the Pops. But the two singles I bought were Black Knight from Deep Purple and A Paranoid by Black Sabbath.
Two very good choices.
Yeah, so that's kind of indicative of where my passion from a genre point of view kind of started. And I still today, my own band right now is working on a Nirvana cover set right now for the next employee get together weekend. So that'll be something new for me.
Very cool. And to share mine with you then, so interesting. So my first two were Flight of Icarus, Iron Maiden, and I Am I Me by Twisted Sister. and funnily enough, the next gig that I'm going to is Download Festival to see Metallica play like two sets, you know, the Thursday and the Saturday, as well as a whole bunch of other amazing bands that are playing across that 4 days, because it's, I think, the 20 years anniversary. Can't remember, but yeah, really looking forward to that.
Yeah, they must be traveling in a pack, because the headliners at this festival in the desert I'm going to is Metallica's there because they're promoting their 72 seasons. And Tool, Ozzy, which I the fact that he's still getting up, because I've seen Ozzy in so many final concerts now. He and Mick Jagger, I think I've seen the Rolling Stones doing their final concert all the way back to 1972. It feels like.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I remain there on that roster too.
Yeah, likewise. And finish up then with you, Andy. I know you're going to have a busy day there, but you mentioned the widow of Leo, and I love that mission statement. I don't think any company can come close to that. Do you think Leo, founder, would think that the company started has fulfilled the potential that he saw nearly 80 years ago now?
Yeah, I'd like to think he would. Because, you know, Leo was not a guitar player, but he was one of the world's greatest listeners. And like many of the greatest designs that have sustained, like the Porsche 911, the design was based on form following function. So I think the reason that a lot of the basic forms that Leo created in the Stratocaster or the Telecaster or the Precision Bass, which was first electrified bass guitar that ever occurred, but he was also creating guitars like the Duosonic with short scale necks and simpler constructions for student players. So I like to think that what we're doing right now is just really a contemporary rendition of what Leo was always doing. And I used to say, you know, some people who are not kind of inside baseball, you know, say, well, the Stratocaster hasn't changed in 80 years. And I go, well, that's true. The only things we've changed is the body profile, the pickups, the frets, the electronics, the tuning keys. But, you know, everything else has stayed exactly the same. And we don't make those changes randomly. We have relationships with 5,000 artists and we conform to their needs. We're trying to give them wings to fly, and the tools that they need continue to evolve. And they're evolving very quickly on the amplification side. There are still absolute devotees of the original tube amps that Leo created in the 50s and 60s. But, you know, we now have very sophisticated, you know, digital variations of those that kind of create that sound and kind of be used for, you know, modern venues and modern recording. So I'd like to think that we've honored his memory.
Great answer. And something you alluded to a little bit earlier. What determining factor or factors do you think are the biggest ones when it comes to people not realizing their full potential?
Well, I think it's fear. Fear of either not taking a risk in their career, because I always bounced around a Nike depending on where the opportunity was. You know, it didn't concern me to move from finance to marketing. It didn't concern me to, I mean, I moved from being CMO to literally setting up a pirate's flag to give birth to the equipment division, and then came back in as CMO again. All of these moves were to go where the opportunity was. But I learned so much every time I kind of moved into an entirely new discipline. So I think it's being flexible, being having a willingness to adapt. And you know, for me, my hiring preferences is intellect. And in a personal skills, you know, if people really have the ability to work with others, that's a strong plus for me. And, you know, I always like to hire people that are way smarter than I am.
Yeah, that's something that I learned from my old boss, Richard Branson. I could see that with every new company that he used to start. He literally just used to, you know, when he set up Virgin Sports, he took the CEO of the biggest sporting event in the world, the New York Marathon, put her behind the desk, gave her 3 support staff, went, crack on, start a business, you know. And I saw that repeated at Virgin Startup when I worked there as well. And I think it's sound advice. And look, what would you give somebody to help them get to where they want to be in life? It could be a piece of advice, it could be a song, it could be a movie, a book, a guitar even. It could be anything. What would you recommend to get someone from where they are now, Andy, to where they want to be in life?
Well, I always looked at the job I had at the time and said, oh, well, actually, I should step back a little. One of my father's maxims were, whatever you do in life, leave it in better condition than when you started. And for him, that was almost a motto for survival when you're in the mines, because, you know, if you're working 3 shifts in the mines, you wanted to make sure that the space that you left for the next crew that was coming in was safe and workable. So I always approached every job with that type of mentality and said, you know, I really want to do a good job at this job. But at the same time, I was perpetually thinking about, is there a better way to do this? You know, never assume that you have to, you know, just come in every morning, you know, punch your time clock and, you know, go through the motions. It's to kind of really think about what you're doing and think about whether or not there are other ways to improve it. But I find that that's the case. And then you're willing to speak up and say, hey, I've thought about this. You know, maybe there's another way to do this. I think that's when people start to notice you and creates kind of future opportunities for you. And sometimes those opportunities might arise in places that you would least expect.
Yeah, agreed. And last question to let you go. Where's Fender's focus right now? We're into May 2023, looking at the rest of 2023 and beyond. What trends are you seeing? What's the focus right now, Andy?
Well, I think, you know, as we speak, we just introduced the signature guitar for Steve Lacy, who's, you know, not already huge now, but I think, you know, here's a guy who's still taking lessons but producing music that's, you know, really being kind of enjoyed globally. But we're also putting a lot of energy behind, you know, this Fender Player platform, which is kind of the first Fender guitar that most people would use. Which again, if you look at when you see the campaign that we've got, it's very much about celebration of the diverse landscape of young music, if you want to fresh music these days. So I'm excited about that. And then, you know, later in the year, I think you're going to see some real innovations from us on the digital side of amplification. And you know, that's a project that's been a couple of years in the making here. I'm really excited about. So lots. I'm wildly optimistic about the future of the industry, the future of music, and of course the future of our company.
Love it. And if I were to take up my vow and try again to learn the guitar, what guitar should I look at to get started at, Andy?
I would pick up the player. Pick up the player. It's just a very solid instrument. Great place. It's a great choice to be your first Fender.
Right, let's do it. Okay, amazing. Andy Mooney, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, I'd massively appreciate it if you could help me with a couple of things, so the show's message can reach and help more people overcome procrastination and get to where they want to be. Firstly, tap the follow or subscribe buttons on the platform you're listening or watching this show on. Did you know only 10% of this show's listeners follow or subscribe to the show? If you do, you'll be the first to be notified when a new episode drops. Secondly, if you're able to rate and review the show, simply by scrolling down and tapping the 5 stars to rate the show and clicking write a review to leave a review. Thirdly, and lastly, follow the show on social media by going to @AlexChisnell on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, or @AlexChisnell_ on Instagram. If you've enjoyed listening to this episode, can I encourage you to follow the show by clicking the plus button in the top right-hand corner of your screen if you're listening by Apple Podcasts, or the follow button on Spotify and other platforms. It means you'll be the first to be notified whenever a new episode goes live. Did you know that nearly half of podcast listeners find a show through searching online? So if you've gotten any value at all, please share this episode with one or more of your friends and make it easy for them to find a podcast you think they'll enjoy. If you'd like to join the Screw It, Just Do It community, go to podpreneur.co.uk/get in touch to sign up to our weekly newsletter and free resources. That's podpreneur.co.uk/get-in-touch. That's podpreneur.co.uk/get-in-touch.